After letter I. Ah, nella battuta di due, un tatatam, c'è un... Non ho sentito gli occhi di lì. Beh.
What you've just heard was a fragment of a rehearsal conducted by Arturo Toscanini as he prepared to record one of the works to be heard later on this, the sixth of NBC's new broadcast series, Toscanini, the Man Behind the Legend. This is Ben Grauer. Welcome to another broadcast of Toscanini, the Man Behind the Legend, where each week we bring you music performed under the baton of Arturo Toscanini, conducting the famed NBC Symphony Orchestra, and where also at our intermission time, we learn about the man behind the legend as friends and colleagues of the maestro recall their memories of him in warm and intimate word portraits. Howard Taubman, distinguished author and critic of the New York Times, we'll bring you recollections of the maestro's transcontinental tour with the NBC Symphony, as well as anecdotes about his almost 30 years of association with him as critic and friend. Many of you have written to ask about future intermission guests and also about the music that will be scheduled, and we will give you that information at the close of our program. For this broadcast, we have selected recordings with the NBC Symphony of music by Mozart and Prokofiev. And our program begins as Arturo Toscanini conducts the Symphony No. 40 in G minor by Mozart. Thank you. Arturo Toscanini and the NBC Symphony Orchestra have just been heard in the Symphony No. 40 in G minor by Mozart. In the personal files of the Toscanini family at Riverdale, New York, there are innumerable newspapers, magazines, and books devoted to the life and accomplishments of Arturo Toscanini. Among the books, one may find biographies and critical studies by Samuel Schwarzenegger, B.H. Hagen, Lawrence Gilman, Robert Marsh, Filippo Sacchi, and, of course, the biography written by our guest intermission speaker, Howard Taubman. His book, titled The Maestro, The Life of Arturo Toscanini, published in 1951 by Simon & Schuster, was written after 20 or more years of association with Arturo Toscanini as both music critic and friend. It's our pleasure to bring to our NBC microphones the distinguished drama editor for the New York Times, Howard Taubman. Mr. Taubman, I know that you've had a long career as a newspaper critic and editor. Although I realize you are now the drama editor for the New York Times, during the Toscanini era, you were primarily concerned with music.
I was music editor from 1935 on, and I began writing about music in 1930, so I feel as if I witnessed a great part of the Toscanini era.
When was your first real intimate conversation with him?
Well, it occurred in 1935. It was the final concert that Toscanini gave with the New York Philharmonic, The Farewell. And if you recall, there was a great to-do because at the end of the concert, some photographers came and let off flash bulbs.
He ran down the center aisle and popped the bulbs in his face.
And the maestro, it was said, was blinded by them, and indeed he did not return for curtain calls. I was then a young assistant music critic and reporter, and I went back to the office, and our night managing editor was alarmed by the report that he had read somewhere that Toscanini was blinded by the flashbulbs. So he collared me, and he said, "I understand there's a party that the Philharmonic is giving for Toscanini.
Farewell.
A farewell party. I don't know whether he's there, and I will not rest easy until I have an eyewitness report that Maestro is not blinded, or if he is blinded, I want to know how badly. So you are assigned to go there and see."
It wasn't easy for a reporter to burst into a party.
They didn't want the press at this party. It was to be a party just for Maestro and the musicians. Sure. But I worked my way in. I won't tell how now. And I approached Maestro, expecting to be bounced on the head, because at this moment he was supposed to be very irritated with the press. He knew me. He gave me the most cordial welcome. He insisted I sit beside him, and he wouldn't let me go home. He talked at great length about his career with the Philharmonic, but his eyes were facing the future, and I recall the thing he wanted to talk about most was the fact that he was going to Israel, it was then known as Palestine, to conduct some concerts with the Philharmonic there.
That had, for Maestro, and I guess for everyone, certain political overtones. Here was this deeply patriotic Italian who was not in tune with Mussolini.
That, and remember, it was 1935. It was a way for Maestro to say how defiant, how much he loathed Nazism. Indeed, the orchestra was made up of many refugees from Hitler Germany. So to him, it was much more than a musical event. It was one of the key events of his life, and I think it remained that.
Maestro always had a lively interest in the world around him, the larger world other than music.
Oh, yes. I found that he was alert to politics, to all kinds of things. And I really got to know Maestro in the course of the transcontinental tour that Maestro led with the NBC Symphony in 1950. Having joined the tour fairly early, I guess I was one of the standbys, and Maestro was very happy to have somebody around whom he could talk to, not only about music, but about anything, world affairs, and he made a habit of inviting me to join him in the after-concert supper. Nearly always, those were served on the special train. Maestro had a special car with his own chef. Well, I was expected at the supper on the train after the San Francisco concert. Unfortunately, the train was in Oakland, and I meant to come right to the train after the concert because I knew Maestro wanted at least his champagne, if not food. But by great ill luck, I got a taxi driver who lost his way, and it wasn't anybody's fault, but I arrived sheepishly, at least 45 minutes to an hour after supper was supposed to be served. Maestro wouldn't start until I had arrived, and when I arrived, I expected he'd be very annoyed, but instead, he stroked his mustaches in the way he had of being very, very mischievous and witty, and he gave me a look, and I said, "Maestro, what do you think?" He said, "Oh, it must have been a fine young woman." Well, I never could persuade him that it was just a taxi driver who didn't know his wife.
A misguided taxi man across Oakland Bay. I know Maestro from the days of Studio 8H in Carnegie Hall, the same superb level of performance all the way across the country.
No.
Really, no?
The performances were mostly wonderful. There were one or two that didn't please Maestro. You and I would have found them quite satisfactory. But the one that I remember with considerable amusement was a concert in St. Louis where the hall was very poor. It was, I think, a movie theater, and there was no band shell. There were drapes. And Maestro actually gave what I thought was a brilliant performance of the Eroica by Beethoven. But it didn't come across, and he knew it was not coming across. After the concert, we met in the special train again, and some other people had arrived before I did, and they had told Maestro that it was a great performance, and the more they told him it was great, the madder he got, because he knew that it had not communicated everything he wanted to, and as I walked in, there was a grim look on his face. He grabbed me by the arm, and he turned to the others in the train, and he said, "Now, here's an honest man." Now, I didn't know at this point what I was supposed to be honest about, but I was beginning to be a little nervous. And Maestro said, "Now, what did you think of the Eroica?" Well, like George Washington, I couldn't tell a lie at that moment. And I said, "Well, Maestro, I've heard it done better, though it wasn't your fault." Well, that saved the evening for him. He grinned and he said, "See, I told you you were flatterers," and we went to supper.
That insistence on truth and honesty, his own inner truth, went through him all through the years.
Yes,
he was unsparing on himself.
Yes, I think that explains the man as much as anything, the uncompromising integrity in everything, in his own attitude toward himself, and of course, in his attitude to the music and his attitude to the other musicians of whom he expected as much as he would give himself.
Well, Howard Taubman, as a long-range professional viewer of music as performed here in the United States, what would you say is Maestro's mission or place or what he left for us?
For me, it has always been a question of his greatest bequest were the standards he set. Standards of what we just mentioned, integrity, standards of interpretation that played fair with the music, but it was always 100% commitment on his own part. The maestro is unique. I feel that he is like an eternal conscience for the purity and the unrelenting fight for the integrity of art. From time to time, I refresh myself in a way that I cannot find any other way. It's to take some of those old records of Toscanini, and you know, with the first chord, the clarity, the precision, the fire, the passion, you feel you're in the presence of greatness.
The presence of greatness. Thank you, Howard Taubman. Our guest intermission speaker has been Howard Taubman, author of The Maestro, The Life of Arturo Toscanini, now drama editor for the New York Times.
Here is writer-producer Don Gillis.
You remember your first broadcast? Were you nervous?
Yes, I think I was nervous, and in fact, I think I was nervous until I got to know, get the feel of the orchestra and the feel of the program, and particularly the timing problem. Mm-hmm. Because, as you know, although Maestro had remarkable built-in metronome and timing in his mind or in his musical disciplines, we sometimes would be left short or long, anywheres from 30 seconds to a minute mm-hmm. could happen. I think you came to the program around 1943 or 4?
I came in 44, in the summer of 44, and I think I'd had five or six shows under my belt before mm-hmm. Maestro returned for an all Beethoven.
Yes, series. So
I,
as to nervousness, I think in the beginning, until I began to feel that if it did run short, I would have a reservoir of fitting comments to make. It's one thing to introduce a string trio and or talk about it, and another to talk about Maestro and the orchestra if they're a minute short. Then, as to nervousness, curiously, things would be fine that run like a well-oiled machine with Maestro on the podium and you mm-hmm. in the control booth. And yet, if something went wrong from my end as the broadcaster, right underneath that thin veneer of tranquility, there was a seething, a sea of terror, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was a tenseness until the bells rang.
That's right.
At the end. I remember you were in a broadcast booth, which had been once a client's booth, I think.
That's right, it was.
Your microphones were set up. You must have been about 100 yards from the control room.
It was a long haul from my glass down to the podium.
We communicated by phone
yes.
and a series of lights. Do you remember
that's right.
There were
yes.
two lights.
There was a go-ahead light and a standby and a go-ahead light, as
mm-hmm.
I recall.
I think we had a set of signals for,
yes.
because we couldn't communicate in person, as it were.
That's right. The client's booth was on the, I guess that would be the west end, my booth, and your control room was in the mm-hmm. east end lower down.
I'm going to ask you to remember a day, a Sunday afternoon or a Saturday afternoon in Studio 8H, really back in the 45, 46 period when you were sitting in your broadcast booth. Let's begin. The orchestra's just come on stage and take it from there and tell us exactly what happened.
The routine was, even before that, I would go in to greet Maestro. I'd walk into the triangular dressing room. There was the piano over on the right, taking one angle of the triangle. Then on the long arm of the triangle, the hypotenuse, mm-hmm. was the large sofa, you
yes.
call, and some scattered chairs. And over to the other end was the dressing room. Maestro usually was fidgeting, do you recall?
Yes.
He was walking back and forth with little short steps mm-hmm. and his head bowed, walking with his head between his shoulders, as it was, walking back nervously, but more energetically than nervously. Mm-hmm. Concentratedly, energetically,
head bowed, and he'd look up sharply at whoever came and give them a quick little smile. His greeting to me, he'd say hello and he'd give me a little pat on the cheek.
Yes.
There was always a sense of fatherly relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Then there would be always a hurried, quick discussions on some particular passage in the music or something he wanted to be sure. He'd call in a woodwind trio to say, now, don't forget, in the such and such passage, I want them ben marcata, bang, bang, bang. And going over little bits, am I right, Dave?
Yes. It was a very busy little room, always prior to a broadcast.
Then I would, after that pleasant ritual was over, I'd go upstairs, no, out and around to the control room.
That's right.
And check script with you.
Mm-hmm.
And what are our timings, and so I'd know when we were on schedule, a few little changes in the program notes, which had been prepared probably by David Hall, I think.
And David Hall, Clarice Ross.
Clarice Ross, oh, yes, mm-hmm. yes. And whatever research and fixing I had done and little things I wanted to insert. Then there would be optional cuts in case we were tight. Do you remember?
Oh, yes.
And we'd measure out in case Maestro ran over on the left, not
and
ran
also
over.
Also optional fills in case we were short.
That's right.
I think I gave you the same piece of copy week after week for a while because we never used
yes.
it.
Yes, what was that about?
Well, there were...
It was an institutional thing about how the orchestra was
yes.
its place in the broadcast schedule. That got to be greasy from much handling and
yes,
little talking. Little
and in the control room, the good-natured banter, I think that I remember those pre-broadcast days, there were always a few jokes, although all of us were really and truly not in a joking mood. We were tense, and that was the sort of humor that
yes.
grows out of... And anyway...
I think, you know, I'm thinking also of the engineers, our
George Mathis, for
George
example,
Mathis,
Charles Gray,
Charlie
Bob Jackson.
Gray. Yes. Hollis Young for a while?
Hollis Young. Well, there were a number of course, the men with their vacation schedules and all. There were Gil Markle was...
You know, the interesting thing is none of them professed to be music lovers or music understanders. They almost prided themselves, the engineers, on the fact that this was a mysterious world, that is the emotional and artistic, if you will, world of the music. But as to the technical... quality of pickup, they prided themselves in the fact that they were able to discern this voice in the orchestra or that and the mic placement. And technically, Don, didn't we fool around with many mics and finally end up with one?
When I first came here, Ben, there was a sort of a cornfield of mics, that is,
yes.
many mics.
Yes.
I had always believed in a single mic pickup, and the orchestra during 8H and most of the time in Carnegie Hall, with exception of solos or chorus, was normally a single mic pickup.
At the very beginning of our program, we brought you a fragment of a rehearsal being conducted by Maestro Toscanini in preparation for a recording of the Classical Symphony by Sergei Prokofiev. Let's take just a moment to revisit that rehearsal scene and then immediately afterward hear the work which he was rehearsing, Prokofiev's Classical Symphony.
Prokofiev now. After letter E, after letter E. Ah, io nella battuta di due, un tatatam, c'è un... non ho sentito gli ovoli lì. Bene. Peccato, eh? Vale. Ready, 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 oi là!
Thank you.
Classical Symphony by Sergei Prokofiev, with the NBC Symphony conducted by Arturo Toscanini, brings to a close another in NBC's new series, Toscanini, The Man Behind the Legend. Earlier, we heard Mozart's Symphony No. 40 in G minor, and Howard Taubman was our intermission guest. As we said earlier, many of you have asked for information on future programs. Well, next week, our intermission guest will be Mrs. Lionel Pereira. 2 weeks from now, we'll hear the overture to Colas Brugnon of Kabalevsky, Don Juan by Richard Strauss, and the Daphne and Chloe Suite No. 2 of Maurice Ravel. Carl Glassman, former timpanist of the NBC Symphony, will be our intermission guest at that time. On the following week, our music will be that of Rossini's Semiramide Overture and Schumann's Symphony No. 3, with Gregor Piatigorsky as our special intermission interviewee. Your comments are appreciated and are warmly welcome. They should be addressed to Toscanini, the man behind the legend, NBC, New York City. Toscanini, the man behind the legend. NBC's new broadcast series bringing you the NBC Symphony, conducted by Arturo Toscanini, with word portraits of the memories of the man behind the legend by his friends and colleagues. Script materials are taken from the files of the Toscanini family at Riverdale, New York, and the broadcasts are produced for NBC under the supervision of Don Gillis. This is Ben Grauer speaking.